and welcome to IIEA Insights with me, Dan O'Brien. The global population explosion peaked more than half a century ago, and population growth started to slow. What happens next? The most closely watched demographic forecast, that of the UN's population division, points to the second half of this century before the worldwide population starts to fall. But the precipitous decline in birth rates in recent years means that peak population could be reached much, much sooner. Our guest today, Klaus Vistesen, believes it could be just a couple of years away. He has good reason to believe this. Between 2016 and last year, births in China halved. Today, more than half of the countries of the world are recording fertility rates below 2.1 children per woman. That is the rate needed to maintain a stable population. Increasingly, these countries include not just the rich and secular ones, but poorer and more socially conservative ones, such as Bangladesh, India, Turkey, and many more. Klaus has written extensively on demographics and the multiple implications of the ongoing global demographic transition. He's also chief Eurozone economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics in London, and his Alpha Sources blog has been included in the list of the top 100 economics blogs compiled by intelligenteconomist.com. Klaus, you're very welcome, and thanks for giving us your time today.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So with that, Klaus, let's start, I suppose, with those really arresting figures on the baby bust in so many countries, including stark East Asian figures, but not only there. 10 million fewer babies are being born annually than just a decade ago. What do you think is driving lower birth and fertility rates globally? And how do you evaluate the frequently made claim that it's economic factors, high child costs, high housing costs that's driving this?
So I think if we think about falling birth rates going all the way back from the start of the Industrial Revolution, demographic transitions, I think we tend to have two explanations for why fertility rates fall over time. One is because as we get richer, instead of translating higher economic wealth into more quantity of children, we tend to translate them into the higher quality of children. So we get fewer children and we invest more in their education. That's one driver of why fertility is falling. But that can only explain why fertility falls. That probably can't explain why fertility falls the way we've seen it now. And so the second explanation that we come up with in sort of the literature is this idea that birth postponement, tempo effects, that, you know, as women go through the generations and as we see women, one generation after the other of women, they tend to have their first child later and later and later. And of course, that has, you know, lagged effect on how many children they might have overall. But it also means that period fertility, which is what we're seeing now, you know, total fertility rates can fall very, very rapidly for over a very, very short period of time. So I think some of the examples you mentioned where right now we're seeing very sharp fertility declines in Southeast Asia and other countries, countries which we might even say are developing countries. I think, you know, the most plausible explanation for that is, you know, because we're seeing that birth postponement that's driving period fertility down a lot. Which brings us to the second question, the second element of your question. Why is this? Is this because it's, you know, you're seeing more economic adversity, cost of housing, it's more expensive to start a family, you know, families are postponing birth, family formation. I think that's part of it. I would say maybe in our part of the world, I think maybe sort of in the Western, in the richer part of the world, that's probably a bigger part of it, right? That maybe younger generations today, their actual quality of life compared to their expectations and what they thought they would have maybe has declined. And that means that they are postponing that kind of family formation. And we're seeing that in the data. I think maybe in the poorer parts of the world, I would probably tend to ascribe it generally to postponement because women are getting more educated. Younger women are now having education and seeing it, their education levels increase to a much higher extent than their predecessors. And that's driving a very, very sharp decline in birth rates. And the final point I'd mention here is that we have two conflicting stories here. One is a sort of positive story, right? Women are getting more educated. They're choosing to spend more time in education and they're getting, you know, wealthier. And that's and as a result, they're having fewer children, you know, in a way, you know, that could be a force for good. I mean, maybe that's a good thing, right? That women are getting more educated. And then we have a negative story where maybe the the economic cost of starting a family is driving some families and women to have children later. And one thing I will make very, very clear, and this is really important, I think, for listeners and viewers to understand, is both can operate at the same time. And perhaps what's happening is that if both are operating at the same time, we're seeing some very, very sharp declines in fertility in some countries, right? Because both are kind of operating at the same time. But I think that's probably the most plausible explanation for why birth rates are falling very rapidly at the moment.
And the division between socially conservative countries, that seems to be becoming less. Countries like Iran, Turkey, Bangladesh seems to be becoming less important. At the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been a big increase in education levels and employment rates in say a country like Bangladesh. So I'm wondering, is there something else going on? Is there, you know, public policy that for so long was geared to try and suppress population growth because it was so high that it's actually been effective and maybe in some cases too effective?
So good question. I think it's very difficult to answer on a sort of country by country basis, right? I mean, you need to look into the individual countries. I would say there could be, again, so again, the literature talks about, you know, you have this cultural evolution process, is learning by doing, as if one country does it, the other country. And if you see that in different types of different parts of the economy and country, you know, you can see that behaviors are sort of flow from one sector to the economy to the other. There could be something like that going on. But again, I would say that in conservative countries, one thing we really need to look at in particular is where, so normally in conservative countries, we would say that they have a quite high degree of sort of normal family formation, marriage rates. People get married relatively early and they have children relatively early, right? This should be sort of a traditional conservative trait. And so one thing we're seeing in some conservative countries is that that's starting to change a lot. People are getting married later. They might not even be getting married at all. And if that happens in a conservative country, we should expect fertility rates to decline very, very quickly. Now, to be 100% sure, I don't know how the data looks in Iran or Bangladesh. I mean, but that would be some of the things that I would be looking for if I was going to analyze case studies like that. That generally in conservative countries where a relatively high marriage rate for a long time has been associated with relatively high birth rates, if the marriage rate falls back, you know, we should expect to see birth rates fall very rapidly.
A lot of talk these days, and unfortunately it's become a little bit politicized, but a lot of talk, I suppose it always has, this issue of policies aimed at boosting births and child's number of children. Can you think of any country in the world that has sustainably either arrested population decline or boosted it because of specific policies? Because I am just not, you know, there have been some cases, I think, in Scandinavia where things have been done, but there doesn't seem to be any country that I'm aware of that has taken a policy stance that is viewed as being successful in sort of stabilizing birth rates.
No, I agree with that. Again, generally, if you survey sort of what the literature says here, it says that, you know, governments can throw a lot of money at this stuff, but it doesn't. I mean, it's a tough ask, right? Once birth rates start to fall and these kind of mechanisms kick into place, it's very difficult. Generally, though, again, if you go through the literature, you find a couple of cases that are usually bandied in terms of where countries have been successful. Scandinavia is one, right? You know, you have a welfare state in Scandinavia that gives quite generous childcare support relatively early on, which incentivizes women, even as they go through the career, to have children relatively early. But even in those countries, I mean, I'm from Denmark myself, and I can tell you, you know, you're seeing the same decline in birth rates now, and women are having children later and later and later. So again, it's not obvious to me that they have been that successful, but again, it's maybe at the margin. France is another one where, particularly, France is a country where birth rates fell very sharply in the middle of the 90s, and then birth rates rebounded quite quickly. And one argument in literature is this because France, again, has introduced some policies here which were quite significant. But like, so for example, before we went on air, we talked about South Korea, right? And the South Korean government, they've thrown billions at this problem, and yet South Korean fertility is just collapsing, right? So in theory, it's very easy to say, look, I mean, if you want birth rates to be higher, what do you need to do? Well, you need to incentivize women to have We do focus a lot on the women, but again, you need to incentivize families to have their children earlier, right? Give them an economic incentive to have the children they would like early on, even though they might feel that maybe they don't have the position, the career to do it, and it's expensive. But you know, you can give them some help, tax relief, whatever. But even if you do that, I mean, theory, you know, the empirical evidence shows that it's very difficult to halt these other effects we talked about earlier once they you know, kick in.
And any thoughts on that quite phenomenal decline in halving of births in China? Is it any thoughts on what has driven that, and how much the for example the lockdowns and
the Chinese case is really interesting because it's actually a little bit of a paradox. I mean, we've seen this decline in birth rates very sharply just as the two-child policy has been loosened, right? So you would have expected at least maybe some families were maybe in terms of their ideal fertility size were being held back a little bit by policy, but now they're going out and having children. So, but that's not happening. Again, with the Chinese data, it's a big country, you know, maybe there are some data collection issues. I mean, if you look at the actual what's happened to the data, you know, birth rates were stable and all of a sudden over the last sort of 4 years, it's basically falling off a cliff. It does look a little odd. I mean, in terms of just look at what's happening here. But again, I would say if you run through the analysis there again, I would say birth postponement, tempo effects, you know, the women that you would have expected a generation ago to have their children now, they're saying, no, I'm going to wait. And as that happens, you know, you get that very, very sharp decline in period fertility. And also maybe here, just again, to sort of a technical note, when I talk about period, when I say period fertility, I say total fertility rates. That's a snapshot of fertility. Really, you know, what we're interested in is cohort fertility, the amount of the fertility rate that women have over their sort of entire reproductive career, if you will. And so there is an element in the data here that, you know, especially with assisted reproductive technologies, that, you know, it's possible that we're now in an environment where women in their 20s and 30s are not having as many children as you would expect at all. But then all of a sudden, there might be a bump later on, right? But again, we know that as women get old, it becomes much, much difficult to get pregnant. So I think we should also expect that even though many families and women have an idea, oh, we can postpone, we can have the children later. They might not ever have them, which is why it is significant that we're seeing birth rates fall that quickly over such a short period of time.
Yeah, and incidentally, Ireland is also, we had a situation where in it was birth and fertility was quite closely linked to the economy. But when times got very bad in the 1980s, there was a big decline in births. Around the mid-90s, it picked up again, but we had a very serious recession at the time of the Great Recession, 2008, 2010, and there's been no pickup in birth rates since then. It's been on the decline. So there used to be a sort of link between the state of the economy and births in this country, but that seems to have been broken, and we're joining, sort of heading in terms of fertility and birth rates towards much closer to the yeah. average in Europe. Maybe worth pointing that one out. Bringing the effects of population decline and shrinking working age populations, which is increasingly evident, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, East Asia. What does the literature say about population decline and economic growth?
So I would make like a headline argument first, a headline statement saying, I think you can make a good case that in a modern market economy where you have some form of pay-as-you-go pension system or taxpayer-funded healthcare system, obviously rapid population aging can be a challenge and a problem, right? Because, you know, you get fewer people to pay for more. And so that is something I think all countries, particularly in the Western world, are grappling with because they extrapolate their budget numbers. And obviously these numbers look very bad. But generally, I'm not, again, you know, I think, you know, we need to be quite careful about making that sort of a demographic is destiny argument for economic growth. I mean, obviously there's a lot of things countries can do to raise productivity growth and over especially longer period of time, you know, I think countries can kind of work against that trend. But I do think it's from a public policy perspective, you can definitely make the argument that if you have a taxpayer funded pension and healthcare system, and you're getting much, much more older people relative to the working age population. Of course, that raises challenges, taxation challenges, that raises challenges that you need to face. But in terms of overall growth, and, you know, I don't think demographics necessarily is destiny in that sense. I think we need to be much more open about that than maybe in the literature, which is, it's very, so I'm a macroeconomist. It's very easy in a standard macroeconomic analysis to paint a very grim picture with sort of like you extrapolate and then, you know, you're going to go bust in 20 years because you won't be able to pay for public services. I mean, I think we're probably, you know, probably not that bad.
Okay. I know, brings to mind Italy. I lived in Italy in the 1990s and pension costs were already about 15%. Public pension costs were about 15% of GDP. That has grown very little over the past decades, despite the old age dependency ratio rising. So, you know, as I say, as you say, it doesn't have to be absolutely catastrophic, but at the same time, you know, with old age dependency ratios looking to continue to rise, at some point, you know, will there be a problem, or is the way we're dealing with pensions, raising pension rates, and also very significant increase in the sort of over 55s working in most countries, the employment.
Well, I mean. Exactly. I mean, you mentioned it there. I mean, the economy will adapt, right? I mean, and there are a couple of things that public policymakers can and already are doing. Like, as the population gets older and people are able to work longer, the age at which you earn your pension obviously is going up over time. We see this, right? And this is one of the things you need to do. And I think all public policymakers kind of understand that. But you mentioned another really, really interesting point is that one of the upshots of the falling birth rates is, of course, that we're also living longer, right? I mean, these two things are kind of related in a way if you look at the demographic data. And obviously, the fact that, in particular in Europe and sort of the countries I cover, sort of in sort of my day job, we can see that labor force participation rates, in particular among older workers, is high and rising. And that's fantastic good news because these are resources that maybe 10 years ago, if you were, you know, sitting down with a sort of very traditional model, you would have vastly underestimated how many people were actually going to work later on, right? And they might not have the same type of jobs that they had before, but they're still contributing, and that's important.
So this is one of the things. Productivity is something I think a lot about, and clearly it's been on the decline. The rate of population productivity growth has been slowing in nearly every Western country. The few bumps along the way in some countries, but it certainly, despite, you know, the famous saying, you can see computers everywhere except in the productivity statistics. You know, far more working age adults, particularly with women, have higher education. So there's more human capital, a bigger share of the population is human capital. Older people tend to be more productive than younger people. A 50-year-old who's had long experience is likely to be more productive than a 22-year-old. So that aging of the population should have fed into productivity. But again, not sort of seeing that. Do you have any sort of views on what's happening to productivity more widely?
So productivity, so I would say first, the link between aging and demographic and productivity is very tenuous, right? I mean, I think that this is something that we as economists don't have a really good handle on. I mean, one argument goes that actually productivity peaks with the prime age working age, which is sort of like 35 to 54. And then after that, it starts to decline. But again, I don't think there's any good evidence of that. Generally, productivity, as you say, if you look across what's over the years, and you look at the recorded data of total productivity, what tends to happen with productivity over a long period, over some period of time, it's zero, and then something happens, and then it goes up, and then it tends to go down again. And so we had the IT revolution, for example, from the middle of the 90s to the sort of 2003s, we had a boost in productivity. Then we have zero productivity, and now, you know, everybody is discussing whether AI is going to be the next productivity boom, and so I think that generally I would be very careful making a strong argument between demographics and productivity, because I think, you know, we don't have any good evidence of that. But I think productivity is not a linear process in economics, I would say, from if you just look at the data.
House prices. Do you see any sign that countries with stable or falling populations are having different dynamics in their housing markets?
Well, no, because I mean, yeah. So if you take like the oldest economy in the world, Japan, right? It definitely seems, I think definitely seems there that falling real estate prices since the boom in at the end of the 90s and then the bubble burst, and it does definitely seem that falling real estate prices in general there in that country seems to be related maybe to a shrinking population and the fact that you have a very old population. But then you go to Tokyo, right? It's still very expensive. So I think, again, it's very local. And generally, I would say, and particularly in Europe and particularly in the UK, sure, I mean, birth rates might be falling. And in some countries, you know, the working age population might be shrinking, and maybe even we're going to have outright population decline at some point. But look, the supply of housing is the supply side of the housing, right? And relative to demand, that's keeping prices up, because I think a lot of people have vested interest in that. So I think, yes, in theory, of course, if you have a very long period of time of a falling population and a falling working age population in general, and incomes are shrinking, yeah, you would expect house prices and real estate prices to fall. But there are other factors in play at the moment that just mean that I don't think that link is very strong.
And just to move away from demographics slightly and onto the issue of house prices, which invested interest, you mentioned supply side. Can you think of any from your work around the Eurozone, around Europe, can you think of any countries that's getting its supply side right in housing, that's matching its population growth?
I mean, not really. I mean, again, I think supply side, that we're seeing, I think France and Germany and France, I think they're doing okay, but they still have had like big run-ups in house prices. And if you look at supply demand analysis in those countries, you know, you still have a huge excess demand relative to supply. So I think it's a very difficult not to crack, because basically this is, we can analyze this in the same way we analyze like a rigid labor market. It's an insider outsider problem. All the insiders who already own property, they're not really interested in expanded supply, and they outvote the outsiders, right? This is basically, you know, this is an issue what we see in a lot of European countries, I think.
So you mentioned Japan and it has, I think, 30% of its population is over 65. It is the oldest society in the world. Mm. Are we destined to turn Japanese? Is that where everyone else is going?
Well, in terms of population aging, we're definitely now, and this has been clear from since the start of the 2000s, we as a collective world now live in a world of aging. We're going to get much older, and the age distribution of the globe in our lifetime, in your lifetime, is going to shift. That's without a doubt. The median age is just going to continue to go up and up and up and up. If you match that with the fact that we're living longer, we can work longer, maybe, you know, it's just par for the course. It's a number that goes up, but actually not much change. But I do still think that we are, if you look at sort of very broad global sort of global population trends, we are now over the next 50 years at least going to live in a world of rapid population aging, where the median age and the age, the population pyramid is shifting. There's no doubt. That's baked in the cake now.
In terms of caring for older people, there is some more optimistic view that, you know, it's only in the final couple of years of life, regardless of what age you die, that you need a high level of care. Is that something that sort of says, you know, we're not going to turn into a sort of a society of nursing homes?
I mean, you would certainly hope so. I again, the fact that we are living longer and we have more, if we have better years, right? I mean, this is what you're saying, is that, you know, if you measure life expectancy, not to the point at which, you know, you kick the bucket, but in terms of how long, how big a stretch of your life you're basically able to take care of yourself, that's certainly expanding. So obviously that's great. But again, I still think, you know, I think the classic statistic that gets bandied around here is that, you know, old age diapers now outselling actual diapers in Japan. I mean, these kinds of things. So it is still going to, in some countries, going to create a lot of challenges in terms of how you structure society. But again, I think the economy and society will adapt. I think, you know, in a way, it's just the way we would have expected to do. I mean, I think, you know, our economies will adapt to it.
Yeah, I'm certain. I was in Asia recently in 7-Elevens. There are two separate sections for adult nappies and children's nappies, and they are quite similar in size. US, American exceptionalism. For a good period of time, America was different from Europe and Japan and the rich, high-income countries. That seems to have changed. To be converging. Any thoughts on what's happening there and why, after such a long period of having, I think, some of the highest birth rates in the rich world, that has changed? Is America becoming less exceptional? Why?
I think that's correct. I mean, there was this exception, not just in the US, but the Anglo-Saxon economies in general, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, maybe even and the US, that they had, like, they seemed to have fertility rates which were close to the replacement level and were stabilizing. So the story in the US, again, this is a fairly, I said, this is a fairly clear story if you sort of go through the literature, is that in one of the reasons why fertility rates in the US have been higher was that because the relatively conservative part of the US population were having more babies than the liberal part. So again, this is a very politically charged argument, but I'm just saying, don't shoot the messenger. This is from the literature. It's basically that sort of the Bible Belt and these guys were having more children than the sort of the liberal people on the coast. That's one argument that, that kind of is it, it comes out in the data. But another thing, and that's what the one that's changing now, I think, is that the influx of Latino immigrants in particular had kept birth rates higher, right? That particularly Black women and Latino women were having more children and children earlier, and that's now changing. Very clear in the data, if you look at the last 10 years, I believe, if you look at, if you decompose the decline in US fertility over that period, you can see this because fertility rates for young Black women and young Latino women in particular basically converging on a lower level, right? And that's why birth rates are falling in the US. So yes, I think the US is now an economy which is, again, astonishing compared to, you know, some of the assumptions that was made in the literature just 10 years ago. It's an economy where, you know, probably below replacement fertility now for quite a long time, because we know that once fertility rate starts to decline below the replacement level, I mean, we're talking, it could take a decade for it to come back, if at all, right? So I think, yeah, it's something that's basically happening now in the US.
We might finish up with, I suppose, the most politically charged of all issues these days is immigration. In terms of countries that are seeing their population, their natural rate of population growth, i.e. deaths exceeding births, you know, to what extent is and the aging issue. So to what extent is migration and a looser migration policy the answer to that? You know, many people will argue that, of course, it's age as well. So some thoughts on how migration can assist in dealing with some of the downsides of population.
Well, I mean, as you say, it's politically charged. But again, if you were sitting in a very sort of non-value charged economic model, yeah, immigration is the answer, right? I mean, you just plug the hole with immigrants; it's perfect. It works economic. You know, growth. You know, your population pyramid remains stable. And I would say the only caveat here is that that only works if your country is a relative. It's like China can't replace with immigrants; it's too big. I mean, where would the people come from? So you get to a certain size where, you know, it'd be quite difficult to use immigration as an argument for sort of mitigating some of this stuff. But in a very standard economic model, I'd say absolutely immigration can be an answer, right, for rejuvenating the population or keeping the working age population higher, because in particular, if immigrants are coming because there are jobs, you know, that's a net gain. But that's the economic argument. Politically, we can obviously see that's a huge issue across the board now, US, Europe, you know, and it's a massive problem, because again, it does expose this idea that yes, you know, from an economic macroeconomic perspective, you can come up with this explanation, but trying to implement it, you know, that's very politically controversial, right? And doing it so over time can create some significant political tensions, right? That kind of, and people move to the extremes of the political spectrum and all that stuff.
And a final one, maybe in terms of labor shortages, it's extraordinary to see countries that have had high unemployment for so long having labor shortages, particularly in southern Europe. Do you link what's happening in labor markets in recent years in Europe, particularly, with demographic factors, or are there other things at play?
I think there are other factors in play, but I'm starting to warm to the idea that perhaps one of the key benefits of a rapidly aging population over time for the people living in the economy is that actually maybe, again, the labor market outcome, the labor market possibilities are good, right? Are high, that actually you will be able to find work, and there'll be an abundance of work compared to the, relatively speaking, compared to the number of workers. And then obviously, That generates security and maybe, but not necessarily high wage growth, because I'm not sure there's a bargaining power like that necessarily, you know, translates into high wage growth. But remember, there's another factor in play here, is that if the working age population is shrinking, unemployment is falling, you get labor shortages, that also incentivized shift from labor to capital, which obviously you're seeing, right? So basically, instead of having a checking assistant in the supermarket, you have a computer now. And so these kinds of, and especially in low value added, you see a quite strong pressure towards that. But I'm warming to the idea, actually, that maybe, especially for countries like Southern Europe, which have suffered from endemically high unemployment rates for a very long time, for right now, maybe population aging can be a slightly blessing for them, because it means that actually employment and unemployment's falling. Employment's rising, unemployment's falling.
Good. Well, look, let's wrap it up there. I'm sure we're going to be hearing an awful lot more about changing demographic dynamics in the years ahead, as things are not just changing, but changing at an accelerating pace. Klaus, very sincere thanks to you for coming and sharing your research and thoughts on this phenomenon. Thanks very much. And thanks to everyone else who joined. Have a good afternoon.
Yes. No, thanks to you, Dan, and thanks to everyone who joined. It was a great pleasure to speak to you. And come find me on Twitter or X or social media if you want to talk about demographics.